Students sizing up law schools may take into account how many graduates from a particular institution actually get employed once they have their degrees in hand. Many schools promise jobs after graduation, but not all those legal jobs are quite what they seem. Ashley Milne-Tite from our Planet Money team has this report.
Prospective law students who can't make it to Williamsburg, Virginia, can learn all about the law school there on the web.
William & Mary is the oldest law school in the United States.
Complete with elegant buildings, famous names.
Founded in 1779 at the urging of Thomas Jefferson.
And if you delve into their website, you can see the graduates of William & Mary Law School are doing great in the job market. They have a 90% employment rate. But not all those positions are big-paying law firm jobs. When you dig down, there's a surprising fact. A fifth of graduates are employed by the university itself. They're not working for the school. They're in a fellowship program that pays graduates a stipend to work in public service jobs or for nonprofits. Dave Douglas is dean of the law school.
In this market where jobs are tight, a student needs to have the opportunity to show what they can do.
He says with these jobs, graduates gain valuable experience. Within a year, most of the university-funded graduates land full-time jobs.
And this is what this fellowship program does. And that's why these students succeed.
It does something else, too. It boosts the school's place in the best law school rankings produced by U.S. News & World Report. William & Mary Law School jumped 9 spots this year. It's now the 24th best school in the nation. The dean says that jump happened in part because of the school's improved employment numbers. Moving up in the rankings is a big deal.
I think it has an outsized influence, this sort of rankings obsession in the legal profession, which is very sort of obsessed with prestige.
Karen Sloan is a reporter with the National Law Journal. She says a lot of things go into these rankings, but one crucial factor is how many graduates land jobs. The rankings count someone employed if they have a professional job 9 months after graduation, but they don't care who employs you. So many top-ranked law schools have these school-funded job programs. Georgetown, NYU, George Washington University. Sloan says these kinds of initiatives became popular during the recession when legal jobs got scarce.
So there's really no doubt in my mind that the primary motivation for these programs was to boost employment numbers.
Now, there's been debate in the past about how transparent law schools have been about their job numbers. Until fairly recently, you could be working at McDonald's after graduation and you'd still count as employed in the rankings. Then the rules changed. Now schools provide a more detailed breakdown of the kinds of jobs graduates get. But Kyle McEntee of the nonprofit Law School Transparency, he says there are still problems with these school-funded programs.
They're not purely intentioned. These programs exist to help appearances, whether it's improving the rankings criteria for U.S. News rankings or improving their employment rates.
McEntee says students can't make an informed choice about the return on their investment if they don't know which are real jobs and which aren't. Law schools say, look, anyone can see the nitty-gritty of our employment numbers on our websites. We make it clear how many graduates are on our dime. And the law school students we spoke to didn't feel like anything nefarious was going on. Andrew Bader goes to George Washington University Law School. He says any job, even one funded by your school, is better than no job.
Well, I mean, it's a tough legal market. I mean, especially since the economic crisis in around 2008. Frankly, lawyers aren't retiring or dying nearly fast enough in order for us to fill their spots.
And the schools that run these programs make another point. These temporary jobs are a way to get students into public service. Brian Dana graduated from the University of Virginia Law School in 2011. He had a job offer from a private law firm in Washington, D.C., but he turned it down to go and work in a temporary position on Capitol Hill. A University of Virginia fellowship made it possible for him to do that.
And the fellowship program was actually a year long. But after about 5 months, I guess I proved my worth to my bosses and they brought me on as full-time counsel.
Some of his classmates also graduated to jobs in public service right from their fellowships. Karen Sloan of the National Law Journal agrees the programs are a great opportunity for students at the universities that offer them. But she says overall, a small percentage of the country's law school graduates even have this option.
Some of the schools lower down the U.S. News rankings. They don't have the kind of endowment money. They don't have the finances to do something like this.
If you're one of those schools that doesn't have an employment program, your students are on their own in a legal job market that still hasn't recovered from the recession. Ashley Milne-Tite, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Regis, a global solution for growing companies, offering flexible workspace in 1,800 locations worldwide. More at regis.com/radio.
And that's the business news on Morning Edition. From NPR News, I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
We're going to talk now about a positive public health story here in the United States. This is how things used to be in Denmark, South Carolina.
We had very young grandparents. Grandparents were maybe 30s, great-grandmamas were in their 40s, and parents were in their teens, so a lot of education had to happen.
That's Michelle Nimmons with the Bamberg School District, and she's worked for the past 30 years on the issue of teen pregnancy in South Carolina. And efforts like hers have paid off around the country in the last couple decades. Since the 1990s, teen pregnancies have decreased by more than 50%. Today, in her town of Denmark, South Carolina, every student in public school gets comprehensive sex education, starting in middle school. But that change and others were hard-fought over many years. Michelle Nimmons says one of the biggest challenges to reducing teen pregnancies has been getting people to acknowledge there's a problem in the first place.
Now, remember, South Carolina is the Bible Belt, and we have a small rural community that is isolated. Churches are the central focus of the community. We had to convince parents that we were really just wanting to reinforce the values that they were teaching in their homes, because we truly believe that abstinence is the best option for young people. And that's what parents wanted for their children. That's what churches say is best.
And this is not just about young women. I mean, when we think of teen pregnancy, we think of girls because they're the ones who inevitably end up bearing the burden. But your program, you made an effort to focus on boys as well. Why was that a priority, and what did that end up looking like?
It was a priority because we understood that it involved both genders. Young ladies weren't getting pregnant by themselves, and we felt it was important for the young men to understand what the consequences were when they engaged in sexual behaviors and did not contracept effectively. They don't get to walk away from a pregnancy and not have emotional scars or financial responsibilities. So we have sessions where young men and young ladies are there talking together and learning the curriculum together, because it's important for them to have those conversations. Role playing is a large part of that, because they need to become comfortable with whatever their refusal message is going to be. They need to have an opportunity to practice that, so that when they find themselves in that real life situation, hey, this is what I said I was going to say to get myself out of this, to communicate my message to my partner that this isn't what I want, or to negotiate condom usage.
I understand condoms cannot be legally distributed in South Carolina schools. Where are young men getting access to condoms now? Are you engaging local businesses? What kind of businesses are helping?
We have a barbershop that's owned by two former students of ours, and they have been open and welcoming to us in that they allow us to put the condoms in their barbershop, and they notify us when the supply is running low. They've gone through the program. They're now in their early 40s. They remember the conversations we had with them. They have been positive role models for the young people in our community, in that they both have volunteered to be recreational coaches in the community. So the young men feel comfortable with them. We have a beauty parlor that does the same thing. Another former student owns that. And we have a laundromat that's a couple of hundred feet away from the high school. And we just drop them there, and kids know on the way home walking, they can go in there and pick them up too.
And lastly, I wonder if you have noticed after all these years, the level of sophistication change, how kids talk about sex, has it become more open? Are kids more comfortable talking about it to the point where it's pushing you and your colleagues perhaps out of your comfort zones?
Well, Rachel, times have definitely changed. But one thing I have always said to my staff, never let them see you flinch. And they say things to see if this old lady is going to flinch. And I find it hilarious, because That's just my cup of tea. You want to go there, we can go there kind of thing. But you got to know what the proper terms are also. And we have to stay current because they come up with different terms for everything all the time. It's just definitely a different world now.
And even though Michelle Nimmons isn't afraid to meet teenagers where they are when it comes to talking about sex, not all adults are that comfortable in those conversations.
Sometimes, despite the progress that we've made, we still get a little tongue-tied on these issues.
This is Forrest Alton. He's chief executive officer of the South Carolina Campaign to Prevent Teen Pregnancy. He says despite the declines we've seen in the United States, we still have one of the highest teen birth rates in the industrialized world.
Frankly, it's not even close. So we certainly can pause for a moment to celebrate the progress that we've made, but by no means should we wash our hands of this issue and think we have it solved. There's still a tremendous amount of work left to be done.
Alton wants more funding for teen pregnancy prevention programs, a clear social message to kids that abstinence is best, but safe sex is a must. And yes, he says parents still need to get better about having honest and early conversations with our kids about sex, the risks and the responsibilities that come with it.
I'm in a state that's in the midst of a population boom and a demographic sea change. Texas has more than doubled its population in just 40 years, from 11 to 26 million. It's grown faster than any other state. And overwhelmingly, the fastest growth is among Hispanics, who now make up 38% of the state's population. Hispanics will be the largest single group in Texas by 2020. When demographer Steve Murdoch started tracking this trend decades ago, he met with resistance.
At first, there was a lot of denial. I like to say that I've become increasingly brilliant over time.
As state demographer appointed by Governor Rick Perry, Murdoch drove tens of thousands of miles all over the state. And what he saw was clear. Texas was zooming toward becoming a majority-minority state.
People would say, that'll never happen. You're wrong.
Well, it did happen back in 2005. Now Murdoch warns unless this growing Hispanic population is helped up, the state overall will become poorer and less competitive. Texas will spiral downward.
The reality is that the future of Texas will be tied to its minority populations, and how well they do is how well we will do.
The key to that future, Murdoch says, is better education, leading to higher-paying jobs. So we went to school.
Hey, Laundrie!
We stopped by Dr. John Folks Middle School in the far northwestern suburbs of San Antonio. It's brand new, opened just this past August, and it's gorgeous. Two gyms, a hallway lined with music practice rooms, corridors named after colleges, University of Oklahoma Lane, Trinity University Road. About 60% of the student body here is Hispanic.
Love the bow. Looks cool.
Barry Perez is the school principal and chief booster.
Come on, you can do it, Danielle. I have faith in you. You're going to make it. You're going to do fine.
This school was built with explosive growth in mind. There are almost 600 students now, and the projections are that number will more than double within 5 years. After that?
I do know that when the campus was built, there were provisions so that if we had to put an addition, they already know where that addition will go.
Perez points right there at the end of this hallway. This school is part of the Northside Independent School District, which is humongous, the fourth largest district in Texas. And it's growing by 2,000 to 3,000 students every year.
The growth is really, it's staggering.
It's up to Superintendent Brian Woods to try to manage this growth. He shows me a map with a cluster of red and green dots in the outer reaches of San Antonio's suburbs. These are new schools they plan to build to accommodate the latest growth as the population expands farther and farther away from the city. Think about this. The district opens roughly 3 new schools every year.
Is that a scary thing to look at as the superintendent of this district?
It's a little scary. It's one of those things that wakes you up at 3:30 in the morning, you know, is how are we managing this, and are we doing the things that we need to do far enough out in order to plan for and manage growth.
And overwhelmingly, as with the state overall, that growth has been Hispanic.
This has gone from a primarily Anglo student population to a vast majority Hispanic student population.
Which means when Brian Wood's son goes to his Northside Elementary School each day, the faces there reflect the new Texas.
The school that he attends is very diverse racially and ethnically, and from a socioeconomic standpoint. And that's just the norm for him. It would never occur to him, I think, to see the world any other way.
He's the minority.
Oh, very clearly he's the minority. I think if you went and looked in his classroom, he would probably be among the, say, 20% of students who are Anglo.
Now, most of the growth in the Hispanic population here is not from immigration, people coming across the border from Mexico. These are folks coming from other states or moving within Texas. Remember, as demographer Steve Murdoch points out, Texas has had Hispanics since before there was a Texas. The Hispanic numbers grow, too, because this population skews younger with a higher birth rate. It also tends to be more economically disadvantaged with higher poverty levels. For Superintendent Woods, that means he needs more resources, more staff to bring the disadvantaged students along. So imagine his dismay when the Texas legislature slashed $60 million out of his budget 3 years ago.
It was absolutely infuriating. It was heartbreaking.
He had to cut almost 1,000 staff positions at a time when his student population was ballooning.
To ignore the changes in our state and to ignore public education and health care as infrastructure projects is really to set the state up for dismal times in the out years. These are long-term issues. The great Texas miracle, to borrow a George Bush phrase, cannot last if we don't fund infrastructure.
And do you see any appetite for doing just that?
Virtually none.
Really?
Really.
I just think squandering talent is one of the ugliest things I ever watch.
And so Diana Natalicio has made it her mission to cultivate talent in higher education among the Hispanic population of El Paso. She's been the president of the University of Texas, El Paso, or UTEP, for 26 years. She looked to the future and decided the institution had to transform itself, both to better serve the city's low-income Hispanic population and to raise the university's national standing.
I was told it couldn't be done. It just can't be done. You can't do high-quality higher education with commitment to diversity, commitment to low-income students, because it's just never been done before and you're not going to be able to do it. And I said, well, we're going to try. And we're going to make it happen, and we're going to be the model.
Under Natalicio, UTEP has doubled its student enrollment. Now 80% of the students are Mexican-American, mirroring El Paso. More than half are the first in their families to go to college. Nearly all of them work while going to school. Natalicio says this is the new reality, and we ignore it at our peril.
The peril is that you will have an undereducated and growing group of young people who won't be able to find employment. I mean, this is a story in many countries around the world, right, where, you know, one of the biggest challenges in many of the countries where we're seeing huge unrest is disaffected young people who can't find work and have nothing to do.
Demographer Steve Murdoch has called this the Texas Challenge. But he points out it's not just Texas. It's a challenge facing the whole country as our demographics shift and minorities become the majority. And tomorrow, I'll explore how the changing face of Texas could alter the political landscape here. I'll talk with the mayor of San Antonio, Julian Castro. He looks to the future and sees, eventually, a blue state.
When it comes to a family's budget, one of the big challenges is paying for college. We've been reporting on this issue, and today we're focusing on low-income and minority students. They often struggle to find the money to pay for school, and that can have an impact on the majors they choose. Too few make it into the sciences, fields that often require years of study and graduate degrees. A new program at the City University of New York is funneling minority students into astronomy and giving them the support they need, financial and otherwise, to succeed. From member station WNYC, Beth Furtick reports.
Ariel Diaz first felt the pull of astronomy when he was a Marine stationed in Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. At the time, he says he was miserable, missing his friends and family back in New York City.
And I would go to the beach with my friend Brandon Tilly, and we would go and we would just go to the beach, have a beer, and just look at the stars, and everything was okay.
Diaz finished his service 3 years ago and came home, enrolling in a community college at the City University of New York. When it was time to take a science class, he thought about that time on the beach.
I was like, I like stars, you know, let me take an easy course. Let me take an easy astronomy course.
It wasn't easy. As any Astronomy 101 student can tell you, it's not stargazing, but lots of physics and math. Diaz needed help passing calculus, but he says it was worth it to learn about stars and galaxies.
I've never in my life have I been motivated to do something. And this is the first thing that touched me. It was like, I really like it and I want to do it.
A professor was so impressed, she encouraged Diaz to apply to a new program called AstroCom NYC at the City University of New York. The tuition is fully funded. Diaz was already covered by the GI Bill, but as a low-income student, he's grateful the program also includes a research job in astronomy this summer.
And they're paying us for this opportunity. Like, that's unheard of to me, where I'm coming from.
AstroCom is among many programs funded by the National Science Foundation to bring more underrepresented minorities into the sciences. The country's most famous astronomer, Neil deGrasse Tyson, is African-American, but the data show only 2% of all U.S. students earning doctoral degrees in astronomy and physics over an entire decade were either Black or Hispanic.
So if we just throw a couple more students into grad school, we make a huge impact.
Tim Paglione is in charge of AstroCom. He's a professor at York College at Queens, which is part of CUNY, and a research associate at the American Museum of Natural History. He says CUNY's low-income, mostly minority students often aren't prepared well in high school for all that math and physics, and many of them have to work to pay for college.
We don't want them to be working. We want them to be concentrating on their academics, so we remove that tuition problem.
In addition, AstroCom provides free transportation on the city's subways and buses, plus laptop computers and mentors. Students meet every Friday at the museum for a class on scientific research methods.
So we had three different kinds, with the alpha, beta, and the gamma.
Today, Ariel Diaz and three of his fellow students are sitting in a conference room with their laptops, learning about radiation.
It was gamma, right?
It was C.
But mentoring is expensive. AstroCom has only accepted 8 students since it started 2 years ago. It expects to reach about 25 by the end of its 5-year grant. Diaz's astronomy professor, Savick Ford of the Borough of Manhattan Community College, says there's a reason it's so small.
It's an apprenticeship program because that's what we know works. We can't have one faculty member to 50 students. It's not effective.
Ford says that's borne out by decades of research.
And we have this huge dropout rate, and it's much worse for underrepresented minorities and women.
Researchers say these groups often need extra support, financial and otherwise. They point to a similar program in Tennessee that boosted the number of Blacks and Latinos earning PhDs. But this new one at CUNY starts earlier, beginning with freshmen, to keep them on track. So far, all 8 of the students in AstroCom are still in school, although 2 left for other majors. Betsy Hernandez started the program this year, and her goal is a PhD in physics. She's 35 and works part-time. She says the free tuition has lightened her load.
I would have continued with my student loans, which I didn't want. That's one of the reasons why I stopped at one point going to school, because I wanted to get rid of the debt.
For Ariel Diaz, it's all the other support that's really making the difference. He lives in a small apartment with his father in public housing, where it's hard to even find a quiet place to study.
I just don't have the space. My door doesn't close, and I'll receive knocks all the time.
Diaz grew up here on the Lower East Side. He's grateful for the free laptop computer and the monthly transit card. They enable him to study at the museum when he isn't helping to care for his father, who is blind and has diabetes. 68-year-old Jovino Diaz says he's proud of his son, even if he doesn't fully understand what he's studying. He had very little education himself in his native Dominican Republic.
He's saying, as long as I'm studying, that's what he really cares about, because
as long as you're studying to go forward, you're not going to go backwards.
By going forward, Ariel Diaz says he hopes to become a professor. Someday, he can teach other students and change the face of astronomy research. For NPR News, I'm Beth Fertig in New York.